Welcome to the Harlem Culture Festival here in Mount Morris Park, in the heart of Harlem. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the young prophet of soul, Stevie Wonder.
Here we go.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Next Lander Watchcast. It's a new month, it's a new theme, it's a new recording time. We are recording this on a day that shall live in infamy, shall we say. Not a great day for games media here on Thursday, May 1st, when we are recording this. We've all had a bit of a time when friends have lost their jobs. I don't think any of us are feeling 100% there today. But we soldier on. The Watchcast stops for no one, except me when I want to take a break. And frankly, I don't want to give this movie we are doing to kick off our month of music films the short shrift. Because this is a great movie. Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised, a documentary by The Roots' Questlove, and a great... just insight and documentation of a singular event that is extremely emblematic of the times in which it took place, and I think very important to them. Brad Shoemaker and Vinnie Caravelle, how are you guys doing?
Right. Yeah, yeah. I look. Yes, it has been from the ripples a rough day. You know, obviously for the people who are directly involved. But this movie is. I found it inspiring at the time, and I feel like it is, at the 20,000-foot view, it is a movie about people coming together to try and overcome challenges.
Yeah.
In a kind of wholesome way, if you maybe don't look at it as the hand-wavy, shiny thing to stop people from going out and protesting and rioting.
Yes.
Right? Right. And so...
This is sandwiched right into the mix of the civil rights era. This is New York on a hot summer when, you know, race relations are at a very tough point in American history. The reason we are doing this theme is because there is truly nothing on this earth that I am more romantic about as a human being than music and the impact that music can have on anything and everything.
Mm.
And this movie, I feel like, is particularly emblematic of that in the sense that, you know, protest and social movements and things like that, the music that accompanies those moments in time, I tend to feel like, you know, I feel like it is important, generally speaking, that the soundtrack match the moment. And And the artists that we are talking about here in this documentary are smack dab in the middle of the civil rights movement in the United States. A lot of these people have faced the exact same oppression that the people in the audience have faced at various times in their life, and the music that comes out around this time, you know, the sort of transfer from the kind of rock and pop into the kind of more sort of like more soul and funk and all of that, you know, it comes at the exact moment when it feels like that civil rights movement is kind of coming to a boil.
Yeah, this was 1969. I'm not sure if you mentioned.
And a year-ish after Martin Luther King is assassinated.
Yeah, yes. Like kind of all of the high profile assassinations of the 60s have occurred at this point.
Yeah, they in the movie, I mean, sorry, Alex, we'll probably want to be bopping along.
Yeah,
throughout
like,
this.
We're going to be all over the place on this one.
But,
so,
But there is a part in this documentary where they just line up the kind of political assassinations that happened, you know, the kind of high profile ones, Brad, you just mentioned, where I think it was a JFK.
RFK.
Is it Malcolm X after
Malcolm
that?
X. Yeah, Malcolm X is before that, I
those
think.
Are, those are the four. I think the order, I think, is, I mean, not that the order really matters. I think it was JFK, then Malcolm X, then RFK, then MLK.
Yes. Yeah.
I believe. Those are the four that they cite. I can't remember who is that on stage that says that. I can't remember.
They took the great Martin Luther King from us. They took the great John Kennedy from us. They took the great Bobby Kennedy, but most of all from Harlem, they took Malcolm X from us. And wait a minute, God knows folks here. We're going to make history right here with the black and the white and the Spanish and the Puerto Rican people right here today.
Is it Tony Lawrence? Tony Lawrence is the kind of MC, right? Isn't that his name?
Tony Lawrence is the MC of the festival, yeah.
Right. It might be him that rattles those off. I can't remember.
Well, there's a cut in the documentary. They kind of just show footage as they kind of go over like the kind of precipitating factors for what's happening here. And it really, look, I'm not going to say we are not in extraordinary times here, but hot damn, that is a dense 10 years of turmoil, you know?
Yeah.
Like that must have, like, feel what you feel now and then have people that are leading these movements just getting picked off, right?
Yeah, yeah. That is a sitting president, the leading presidential candidate, and then, like, very extremely prominent religious and social leaders.
Yeah.
Of various types all being gunned down. I mean, that's a lot.
The fever must have been so pitched, you know?
Yeah, and I think one thing that they mentioned here in the documentary is that, you know, there were really two sides to kind of like what the Black Power movement of this time was and sort of the civil rights movement. There was the nonviolent side, which was more the MLK side, and then there were the ones that were sort of the by any means necessary, which was more the Black Panther and Malcolm X side of things. And both sides had leaders gunned down. Like, it didn't matter if you were the nonviolent or the violent side, like, they were both still targeted.
And you got Vietnam going on.
Yes.
And a draft. And like,
and
you know,
as they say in the movie, a disproportionately large Black population being drafted into the war.
And you have, this part isn't necessarily addressed in here, but, you know, large growing income inequality that is happening throughout this, where Harlem at this time is not the Harlem it is today.
The gentrification had not reached Harlem by that stage.
Yeah, so like this is a pressure cooker of a summer.
Like watching this, so I've seen this twice. I saw it a couple of years ago, year and a half, 2 years ago, and then again for this, and then watching it this time, I think as a piece of filmmaking and also especially as a historical document of the Harlem Cultural Festival, which I guess maybe we'll get to later, kind of didn't exist prior to this movie, it seems like.
For the most part, yes.
Because all this footage just sat in boxes and never actually got watched by anybody after it was shot, despite the best efforts of the people who recorded it.
So you kind of framed this early on as like one of your favorite types of documentaries, which is the, we found this footage and it is extensive and crazy and we are turning this into something.
Yeah, so it's like this and Apollo 11, the documentary Apollo 11, are both that, and ironically both of these events were happening concurrently. And in both cases, they were recorded and then nobody ever touched the footage again until 50 years later, somebody came along and made a documentary. But the thing I was going to say is that as both as a film and as a historical document of this event, it is absolutely the right call to center the musical performances in this because those need to be archived and displayed.
Yeah.
But every time this movie dips away from performance to talk about like race relations or the effort to record this thing, or Tony Lawrence's hustle in getting all these acts on board with this thing and putting it together in the first place. Or what was the other one I was just trying to think of?
There's the stuff about the mayor.
Yes. John Lindsay. Right. Like I
6 foot three, Lindsay. John Lindsay.
I'd never heard of Mayor John Lindsay before, but like it was blew my mind when they said he was a Republican mayor because he sounds substantially left of today's Democrats.
Yeah,
frankly.
New York Republicans are
sure. But
well, that era of New York Republicans in particular. But so John Lindsay, a couple of years after this movie, or you know, the events of this movie, did switch to the Democratic Party.
Oh, interesting. Okay, that makes perfect sense then. Anyway, what I was going to say is that every time the movie dips away from the musical performances into one of those subjects, I could have watched a whole like full length documentary about that subject. You know, like every time they start talking about the sort of simmering cauldron of New York in 1969 or whatever, like I was super interested in the history of that whole thing. So like, as much as this is a documentary about this musical event, like just all the historical and cultural social context that they establish around the event, I also thought was super interesting in this and could totally have watched more of.
I think the thing they do that really impresses me, and so this is Questlove's first like attempt at directing a film. Like he had never directed a film before this. And I think he actually has a couple of other documentary projects that are either coming out or have recently come out.
He had that Sly and the Family Stone.
Is that out yet?
I think it's out. I didn't watch it because the Sly story is really tragic. It's a tough one. I don't.
And it takes a turn not very long after the events of this movie too.
Yeah.
So.
And they're not around. They're not a band for that long.
No,
I should say Sly, I think, is still alive.
No,
actually.
Sly still performs it erratically, but yes,
It looks like it might have come out in February. The movie.
Okay,
I really like that band. I think it's a really sad state of affairs. Like,
yeah,
it was addiction and drugs. And,
yeah, we'll talk about Sly and what ended up happening with that band in a little while. But like, so the thing that really impressed me the most about this, other than just the quality of the archival footage and how it's put together here, is Questlove has a real feel for like both how much information to give you, where to put it, and most importantly, how to tie it to the individual musical performances that are happening throughout the movie. Like when, you know, the Puerto Rican, you know, sort of Latin American groups come up, he ties it to what Spanish Harlem is and what it means to be, you know, part of Spanish Harlem versus regular Harlem. You know, what is the national makeup there and all of that. Like when every time there is something that is specific that needs to be talked about, he finds a way to tie it directly to one of the musical performances in a way that I feel like is really smart. But at the same time, the way he condenses the actual newsreel footage and the sort of background information, it's very hard to do a thing that is tight, condensed, but doesn't feel like it's gliding over important details. And I think in almost every single time he does it in this movie, I feel like I got what I needed out of it, and he knows when to move on. Like, there is a real deft touch to a lot of it.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, and I agree with you, Brad. I think it really does work as a musical documentary and a timepiece, right? Like,
yeah.
and that both equally really well. You know, like one isn't sacrificed for the other, and I think that's a real skill. Some of the editing in the beginning I was a little worried about, but it finds a pace. There's some like quick cuts in the beginning that I was like, oh, this is a little Mr. Brainwash at the top here.
Yeah, the one part where they're talking about like street fashion or something, like, and they basically start flashing a bunch of photos of people in different types of dress, and like those go by so fast that I was like, I could have used like an extra 3 seconds of each of those photos just to drink in the fashion a little more. But yeah,
I would just say for my part, I would have totally watched like a 3.5 hour version of this movie that had more of everything, because I totally would have sat through more of this. And a big part of that is the music in this movie is fucking fantastic. Like, I don't know every artist that is featured on this stage, like, intimately. Like, I am not a gospel expert by any stretch. But, you know, I know some of the names that are kind of attached to that scene and who are performing here. Like, I had heard of Mahalia Jackson before, but I think I did not realize just to what degree she was revered prior to watching this. You know, I knew who the Staple singers were. I knew who, I'd heard the name Mavis Staple before, but like, I didn't know anything about like this being a passing of the torch kind of moment within that gospel scene, because Mahalia Jackson was getting older and her health was starting to fail around this time. And I think everyone kind of points to this and being like, this was kind of the moment when she kind of passed her torch on to the next generation of gospel singers.
Yeah, you kind of hear that in here, you know, like maybe Staple literally says like, oh, she was like, you know, I'm not feeling too well. Like, once you take this one for me, kind of.
I didn't know about the dad. I knew the Staples, the singers, the the ladies. I didn't know the dad.
Oh, you didn't know Pop?
I didn't know Pop. I didn't, Pop is great.
Pop Staples. Roebuck Pops Staples, which is a great name. Yeah, there's a lot of artists on here I had heard of, but had not necessarily like dug too deep into their catalogs. There are a few in here that I would say are all-time favorites of mine. The movie opens with one of those, with Stevie Wonder.
What an embarrassing amount of talent.
I know. Just like an absolute virtuoso.
Stevie Wonder, or so this whole things. Thing? You mean
Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder.
Ridiculous. I mean, he's like probably it's one like, of the best vocalists of the last 50 years.
And a more than passable drummer and soloist, right. Let me tell you.
When my wife and I were watching it, it opens with him drumming, and he like sits down. I was like, he's just flexing now. You're just showing off. Like,
you're stunting on everyone here.
Just Come on, leave some for the rest of us.
It's like a pretty good list of heavy hitters, even if you're not familiar with like the gospel scene or the Afro-Caribbean stuff or whatever, mm-hmm. But just like even the very top line, like rattling off like B.B. King, Stevie Wonder, Sly and the Family Stone, trying to think.
Nina Simone,
like David Ruffin from The Temptations is in there. You know, it's like there are plenty of artists in here that absolutely everybody in this country has heard of.
And some, the thing that was really interesting to me as well is some coming up, some coming down, like really, mm-hmm. really interesting parts in their career, because the thing I was going to mention, Brad, when you were talking about this being stored in a box and basically just collecting dust,
yeah,
is this is gold. Like for any of these, this is a murderer's row of talent. And for any of these people, this, a portrait in this part of their career, whatever part it is amazing to have.
Yeah.
Like to see some of these performances.
A treasure trove.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, people are very young or they're kind of exiting.
That's like, you know, one of the more affecting parts of the movie is that he went and found quite a few of these artists who are still alive and had them sit down and watch this footage for the first time since they performed it. Or, you know, that even goes for some of the showgoers, you know?
Yeah.
Like the movie ends on the one guy who I think was quite young. I think he was
like a teenager when this happened.
Well,
yeah.
No, actually, the guy I'm thinking about at the very end looked like he was like probably 6 or 7 tops. Mm.
The one who's like, I'm not crazy.
But the one who tears up at the end.
Yeah.
Like, I think he was pretty young, but like, you know, still like he basically, this thing had been a figment of his imagination for the last 50 years
right.
until this footage was unearthed and he was able to like touch the memory again and like be reassured that this actually happened and it was that great.
Well, let's talk a little bit at the start here just about what this festival is and why it was stuffed into a basement for so many years. So the Harlem Cultural Festival, as they kind of say, was basically put on by the city of New York, and they kind of put it in no uncertain terms. Things were rough, you know, yeah. and there was a real feeling that, like, you know, race relations in the city could kind of burst apart at any time. And so this was one of John Lindsay's, you know, his administration's goals was to try and basically entertain the masses, you know, find a way to give people an outlet so that they don't, you know, on a particularly hot summer, nothing sparks off.
68, a day after the death of Dr. Martin Luther King, in more than 100 cities, violence broke out. Several thousand looters sacked Harlem streets for nearly 7 hours, the worst outbreak of looting in that area's history.
I knew New York was trying not to have a repeat of that in 69.
People were afraid of the anger and rage boiling over.
It's too late now. We are ready to start. We're going to finish it up.
The goal of the festival may very well have been to keep black folks from burning up the city in 69.
And so this event, the Harlem Cultural Festival, took place over 6 different Sundays in the summer of 1969. One of those weekends coincided with the weekend of Woodstock, mm-hmm. and another one happened to coincide, as we mentioned, with the Apollo 11 landing. So basically, there was a lot going on in this particular summer. And so a lot of these performances are spread out over a fair amount of time. I looked at the actual schedule for the festival. The earlier dates had way more acts. The last two, like sometimes it was only like 3 people were playing, but it seemed like also the person who organized and put on the show, Tony Lawrence, closed the show every single time. I assume with some kind of like, you know, both like a housekeeping, here's who we got coming up next Sunday, and also kind of a message of hope type stuff, because he seemed to do a lot of that.
Like a little maybe sermon-esque?
Yeah.
I was very confused when they were like, this is in Mount Morris Park. I was like, where the hell is that?
Yeah.
Like, I was like, where? And I was talking to my wife, because we lived, she had an apartment in the 160s, and I was like, oh, Mount Morris Park is? She's like, that's not a real place. And
then does that not exist anymore?
It's called Marcus Garvey Park now.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was like, and I was like, oh, okay, that is a not very big park.
No. I mean, if you look at where the stage is situated and what the crowd situation is around it, it's not that big of a stage. And the area in which everyone is kind of sandwiched into is not that big. They say somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 people in total attended the thing. I also feel like I heard them say that, like, generally speaking, there were around 30,000 to 40,000 people there in any given day.
That's what I heard too.
Yeah. So I don't think there were ever actually 300,000 people like surrounding a street in New York like that at one time.
The shots are dense though, man.
Yeah. There's still a lot of people
in there. It is shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah.
I mean, there's one point where he even like, all right, we're going to let people come in a little bit closer. And that seems like it fills in instantly.
Like a crush.
You can hear him getting a little nervous almost. Like he's like starting to worry somebody's going to get hurt.
Yeah.
So come on in here. Get close to me so we can feel a spirit. All right. All right. Okay. All right. That's enough. That's enough. All right. That's enough. Let's calm it down. Now, look, let's take it down a little bit.
But, you know, I mean, it's understandably to be nervous. This is a big public event. You know, it's being put on by the city. There's a lot of ways this can potentially go wrong. Seemingly very little to anything does, at least from the historical record. But so while this was going on during all six of these events, television producer Hal Tulchin, or Tulkin, I don't know exactly how to pronounce his last name, was tasked by Tony Lawrence with recording all of the shows. Mm. The city government wanted them to do it just to kind of have the recording of it. And so what they ended up with was about 40 hours of total footage from the various performances. And so it's not technically correct to say no one ever saw it again. There were two television specials, 1 hour each, that aired on CBS and ABC in 1969 that featured snippets from that footage.
Oh, they mentioned that at like 1 a.m. or something like that.
It did not air at a normal hour. Okay. Yeah, I don't know exactly when it did, but it was not super well seen. So those specials aired, and then a little bit of the footage from this did make its way into one or two of the various Nina Simone documentaries that are out there. That is it. Otherwise, this footage was essentially mothballed and sat in a basement for 50 years, and eventually, during that time, Tulchin did go out and try to market the footage and say, like, hey, we can turn this into something, whether it's a movie, whether it's a bigger TV special, something. And every network basically turned him down, saying it just wasn't of interest.
It's bananas to think about in this, like, with the people who are in this and what is going on. I mean, I guess I understand it when you're looking at it, you don't realize it, but like, holy cow.
Yeah.
But I mean, like the movie itself is kind of defiant, you know, because they make the point pretty strongly at the end that like Black history and culture are consistently going to be erased.
Yeah.
People are going
people
to try to erase it.
Right.
It. Yeah. You know, and so, and you know, I think maybe did they save that detail with Tulchin for the end, or does he talk about that early on that he tried to sell it? Tried and tried to the point that he rebranded it as Black Woodstock because he thought it might.
That was at help, the end.
Because he thought it might help him get somebody to pick it up, and that still didn't work.
I shot the festival, tried to sell it. Woodstock was the same year, and Woodstock got all of the publicity. So in selling it, I started to call it the Black Woodstock. It didn't help. Nobody was interested in the Black show. Nobody. Nobody cared about Harlem.
But also, you know, it is a little poignant that he passed away, you find out at the end of this. He died before this movie came out, so he never saw this, but he at least knew they were working on it because they talked to him. But anyway, you know, like it is, like the very existence of the movie is kind of like defiant against that trend of
totally
erasing this kind of thing that like, hey, we are going to take this and make something out of it and make it eternal.
So the digitization of all this footage actually took place in 2004.
Oh, wow.
Because that was when the footage was first discovered. And there was an attempt back then, and I think up until about 2006, to turn that into a documentary, but it never came together for reasons that are not well cited. So I don't know what exactly happened there. But so the digitization was done, but then nothing really came of it. And I think it was all kind of forgotten about for at least another 10 to 12 years after the fact. And somewhere in there is where Questlove got into the orbit of it. He had been looking for kind of maybe a first project to potentially direct, I think. And so it found its way to him. And to him, like, this was just like, you know, this was uncovering the mother load. You know, obviously, as a musician himself and someone who is deeply influenced by a lot of these artists, you know, this would be an amazing thing to work on. I think his disbelief was just like, I didn't even know this show happened.
Right. This should be a thing that is like Woodstock, right?
Yeah.
That people, it's like a cultural touchstone. And
the moment in which it's taking place. Yeah. And where it's taking place.
I was so dumbfounded at the amount of talent on that stage. Mm-hmm. It's like to have that not be, I mean, it really does feel like a singular moment.
Yeah, I mean, it really just reinforces the point about the erasure of the history, you know, that that this name does not just immediately ring bells for everybody in that lives in America, right?
So
Well,
so the thing is, like, I feel like one, obviously Woodstock kind of maybe got in the way of this thing, you know, maybe getting more cultural cachet, because I mean, look, everyone fucking talks about Woodstock. Woodstock is the music festival of the 60s, as far as anyone is concerned. But there were lots of music festivals back then, and, you know, not all of them were as culturally poignant as this one, but certainly there's plenty to talk about that is not just Woodstock. But I feel like the other thing is, these days, you look at any music festival, and there are 300 of the biggest artists you've ever seen in your life on every fucking bill, no matter what it is.
Hmm.
In 1969, getting this caliber of talent together on a stage, certainly Woodstock was a wild thing, and it was a crazy thing that they had all those bands together. But even something like this, having this many, like, burgeoning and classic artists all together at once on a city-sponsored festival is crazy.
That's the thing. I mean, it's free, right? Like, it was free to
attend. It's a free concert.
Right, like, that's the thing, you know? I mean, especially now, but even Woodstock at the time was pretty commercialized, but, like, these days, like, fucking forget it, you know? Like, Coachella or whatever is just probably generating hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't know at this point, but...
Well, it was, I think this was Maxwell House, right? This was the...
That was the sole sponsor.
The one sponsor.
Yeah. But, like, but this is a festival that was put on much more for, like, social and cultural reasons than commercial ones, you know?
Yeah, totally.
There's just, there's something very... and again, I wouldn't presume to understand everybody's motivations, but the sense portrayed in the documentary is that it's more meaningful than just coming to perform for a gig, right?
Yeah.
This is a thing people are coming to because it's a moment. It's you have to be here.
Well, and at the same time, they mentioned that, like, getting artists like this to commit to something like this at this time was very difficult because, you know, there are a lot of challenges involved with doing a festival. You know, what's the security going to be like? Am I going to get paid? Things like that. And, you know, when the people say, oh, no, we got the city to pay for it, I can understand why artists might not necessarily believe that right up front.
Yeah.
They show some of the contracts, you know, for the different artists they got paid and stuff. And they also mentioned that in order to do security, you know, at one point they had to have the Black Panthers there because the cops wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Or I the sense, and I don't know if this was a subtext, explicit text, or me just filtering text, was like maybe they also just did not trust the police officers of the city to
perhaps understandably so.
Yeah. Yeah. To maybe you want your own crew there as well. I'll just go back to the Maxwell House thing just quickly. Not even to mention maybe their questionable ad campaign, but like the, lack of billboards everywhere, like on all these shots in a 2025 context is, you know, obviously there are no monitors, video monitors or television screens or anything like that. It's just such a clean performers on stage on a kind of not sparse. It is a decorated background, but it's not blown out with ads on all the the scaffolding, you know. Like, it's not just like tons of sponsors everywhere, and it's just a different vibe.
No, the stage is basically just looks like the set from the Sonny and Cher show, and it literally just says festival on it. Like, it doesn't even say the full Harlem Cultural Festival. It just says festival.
Yeah, and all the crowd shots, like, it's not like there are billboards and snack stands everywhere in every shot. Like, I'm sure they show the food trucks and the people doing food outside, but it's not giant sponsored things. It looks like more local food stuff.
Yeah, I mean, at one point they cut to, it's like literally they say like a bunch of like, you know, like elderly women and folks were just like cooking, you know, like they just set up outside the festival and were like, hey, come get some food.
And another thing that really struck me was you mentioned the transfers. This is a really nice looking film for the time. Like, this is a really
this
nice
is captured
transfer.
On videotape of the era.
And the audio quality is amazing. Yes. Whoever recorded these acts knew their job and did an amazing, amazing job.
I mean, it doesn't hurt that like you watch like act after act on here. Like, I really don't want to sound all fucking boomer, like things used to be better back in the day or whatever, but it's just like the level of sheer talent and a lot of stuff, like the vocals in particular, but the whole performances, but especially the vocals in almost every case. It's just like these people are in this like sweltering summer in the middle of the city are laying down like studio quality performances that could have gone on an album cut, you know? like over and over, you know, like there's like, again, I'm not going to like sit here and complain about auto-tune and stuff these days or whatever, but like these people are on it, you know?
Like you don't see, I don't know if it's there, but you don't see a lot of earpieces. Right. Like you don't see a lot of,
I don't think there's a single in-ear monitor because I don't think most people have those at this point.
Like it's just raw talent, you know?
Yeah.
We'll talk about what that raw talent is, some of the artists involved and some of the, you know, the cultural aspects that are sort of married to them by the documentary here when we come back. But first, we have to take a quick break. So we will be right back. Brought to you by Maxwell House.
Man found it first in the humid highlands of Kenya and in the misty plateaus of Abyssinia. A little brown bean. And at the heart of Instant Maxwell House is the little brown bean from the rich, moist soil on the misty slopes of Africa.
All right, we are back. And it's time to sort of talk about, you know, the artists that participated in the festival, you know, some of the other players. I do want to call special mention here again to Tony Lawrence. Usually when you watch one of these documentaries and people are talking about a festival promoter or someone who is on stage all the time, maybe making a little bit of a spectacle of themselves, someone comes in and is like, yeah, that guy was a fucking asshole. Nobody says that about Tony Lawrence. Everybody is very, very enthusiastic about Tony Lawrence, what he pulled together here, and just on a personal level, that man, whoever is dressing him,
yeah,
mwah!
they do a montage at some point where you start, it's probably the first time I realized this was over multiple weekends or mm-hmm. days, and I feel like the outfits just kind of escalate from like suit to then like open shirt to then just
a straight up frilly fucking frilly, like puppy shirt
coming out. Right. Yeah. Really, really is great.
I kind of wish we had a little more time with him. He just seems like a fun guy. Also, just like the, I forget if it's like one of his assistants or whatever, who's describing the process of him booking acts. And like, he's kind of like consistently making promises that he can't currently keep unless all the other favors and promises that have been called in also come. You know what I mean?
Tony was a hustler in the best sense. He would make a promise about delivering something and then leverage that to be able to get other people to want to participate. It's all premised on half commitments that are dependent on another, you know, and it all, ultimately, if you're persistent, you pull it all together.
He knew how to schmooze with politicians, and he knew how to talk to entertainers and musicians.
Tony talked a big game, and he delivered. The 69 Festival was huge.
This is show booking 101.
Like, I'm sure it is. It's just like, it almost sounds like this whole thing is sort of this pyramid scheme that if everybody agrees and comes through, then it works fine. But if anybody fails to show up, they're in trouble.
Yeah, I would say roughly a third of the shows that my band booked for ourselves at various venues, usually like we couldn't do it unless this band came in, but this band wouldn't come in unless this other band was headlining.
Right.
It's just the way that stuff works. But so Lawrence pulls it together. Again, John Lindsay, the then mayor of New York, was, you know, fairly enthusiastic about this project. He comes out on stage. He is, I'm going to say this right now, the most like believably enthusiastic about this kind of music Republican I have maybe ever encountered in my life.
Sure.
He seems like he does not seem like a total stiff up there on stage. He seems like he is genuinely happy to be there.
Lindsay would go to the black community frequently and advocate anti-poverty programs.
He made it possible for us 16-year-olds to get our first jobs. He just was so chill.
Lindsay was a hell of a fine man. When we had the riots when they killed King, he was dead in it, right out in the street.
The community of Harlem wants to be safe. They want to be able to walk tall down the street. How to give a
damn about it's just a very jarring moment, like them being like, he's a Republican, but he's not uncomfortable around black people.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe a different atmosphere. Like, look, there are definitely very racist people absolutely marching around. I just feel like there are very racist people marching around right now as well. So hard for me to say like it's maybe that different. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not here to just glaze up John Lindsay. I don't know that much about him as a politician.
I really don't know either.
Yeah. Like, but my understanding is he was not reviled in the city, and it seems like he maybe did some good things like this festival at the very least. Now, again, we open the thing with this drum solo by Stevie Wonder, which I'm going to be honest with you. I think at one point in my life, I knew that he played drums, but I had super forgotten about that before I watched this. And I was absolutely mesmerized watching him do the Stevie Wonder thing, but behind a drum kit.
Mm-hmm.
The man is just going off.
It's just, again, it's a little unfair.
Yeah. He is maybe one of my favorite all-time artists and songwriters, and this is a really interesting time for him because, as they say, you know, Stevie had been performing for a while, but people weren't really sure where Stevie was going to grow up and go to.
That actually randomly leads to one of my favorite moments in this movie, which is that Chris Rock is in it for about 10 seconds.
Yep.
To give one quote about Stevie Wonder.
In 69, Stevie's bordering on, is he going to be like the Temptations, singing his 60s hits for the rest of his life? Or is he going to have this breakthrough? It would have been very easy to sit where he was, to be that famous and not lazy. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is this extremely matter-of-fact, just sort of like analytical, like music critic perspective on where Stevie Wonder was at in the late 60s.
Yeah.
It's like the least Chris Rock thing I've ever heard Chris Rock say before, like completely not in character, just saying like, well, was he just going to sing his 60s hits like the Temptations forever? Or was he going to grow up and do blah, blah, blah? You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. It's just such a weird random appearance by Chris Rock.
It's worth noting, one of the only artists who is in the movie that does not appear on the official soundtrack is Stevie Wonder. I have heard that he is apparently very precious about where his music appears and archival stuff, so maybe that is why, I don't know. But that said, that drum solo is great. It is always fun to see him perform.
I if anybody in the audience knows, I don't know if this is knowledge, Alex, you were able to pick up, but if maybe somebody in the audience knows. My wife and I were trying to have a discussion, and we were pondering, did they get the rights to the music when the people agreed to do the performance and it was being recorded so that they could then make this documentary? Or do you think they have to re-sign the rights on the summer of Soul? Because
they absolutely do.
Yeah, you think they had to put this back? So they had to reach out to all these artists?
Yes, they absolutely had to reach out to all these artists. So not every artist that performed and all the different dates are in the movie. Like, the vast majority of them are. It's only a couple of names, and there were names that I didn't super recognize that don't appear in the movie. So they may have just been cut for time. But yeah, I knowing what little I know about music licensing, almost assuredly, whatever contracts they signed in 1969 for potential rebroadcast of those those performances was probably only for TV rights for anything.
And probably only for the original festival.
Yeah,
right?
For the original festival. Yeah, like anything that appeared outside of that would probably have to be renegotiated.
Mm. That's an intense undertaking.
It is. And, you know, many of these artists are not with us anymore, though many of them also have estates that would be perfectly happy to make money off their music. So I'm sure that's how a lot of this went down. But
I'll just add, speaking of Stevie Wonder, there is a little scene at the end, like a stinger scene with Stevie Wonder. And mm-hmm. I guess, is it his manager or somebody else who worked with him? Where they're like, he's like tugging on him and he's like, man, come on, let go. It's raining out here. And he's like, my clothes are getting wet or whatever. And he's like, your clothes, I bought them.
Mm-hmm.
Man, take your hands off them.
What you mean your clothes? I bought them.
And I had looked it up because I was like, it's like a weird. Like, is Stevie Wonder a dick sometimes? But I looked it up, and apparently that was a bit.
Okay.
They were doing, like, patter.
Okay.
I was very curious who that guy was.
I forgot his name.
I don't think they say.
It was when I looked it up, I saw the name, and I think it was somebody he's got a relationship with. It's like a music coordinator or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I could tell, just briefly looking up, it looked like they were doing some patter and stuff like that, and they were doing a bit. So, because they sell it pretty well, he's like, "Come on, just let me go. Stop tugging on me."
Yeah. So the first artist after that, and again, this drum solo, you know, is kind of the intro to the movie, and then you know, as they are going through kind of like what the civil rights era is, and sort of talking to the first people who you know were at this festival. The artist that we get is the Chambers Brothers.
I imagine, and now I'm looking at them now, I imagine anyone wearing the hats is because the sun was beating down on them, and they were like, just give me that damn hat. Because you see those big sombreros come out once in a while, and you're like, oh yeah, no, it's...
Other than that one cloudy, raining day, yes, it is. It is. It looks pretty badly hot there.
I could every time I saw somebody up there in a suit. That's, I don't know if they're polyester or what, but all I could think about was how hot it had to be in this. Like, I think it's one of it's like one of Gladys Knight's backup singers. You straight up see sweating all the way through the suit jacket.
Yep,
I cannot imagine how hot it was up there.
And there's I think they say at some point they had to have it. There's no lighting. There's no budget for lighting,
right.
So they had to have it face the sun. So they could film it, which is
sucks. Let me tell you, as someone who has been on a very hot summer outdoor stage before, that sucks.
But yeah, sorry, I didn't know the Chambers Brothers.
I didn't know them super well either. Again, they were in that movement. I don't know that band super well, though. I do like the song that they perform here. Hmm. And then we meet B.B. King.
Yes, everybody wanna know why I sing the blues.
Yeah, the youngest maybe I've ever seen him.
Yeah, he's still not that young. I have to imagine he's like close to middle age at this point. But
look, there's a lot of older B.B. King.
Yes. It's mostly what we grew up with is old guy B.B. King.
I don't know why this occurs to me right now, because this is through the entire movie and, in fact, every sort of concert documentary ever made. But I always wonder if the cuts to reaction shots of the crowd actually match those performances, or
right.
Sure.
Are they reacting to this?
Or if the editors are like generally in this, it feels like the bobbing of the heads and stuff generally matches the rhythm of the music. But I always wonder if like some editors of some documentaries like this feel a little more free to mix and match clips from different performances or even different days just to try to make things flow better. I mean, it's just a little technical like editing curiosity.
Yeah,
I bet you're right. I mean, because there's during the performances is always a little bit of you know, editorializing or commentary, and the cuts seem to match a lot of what they're talking about.
I guess I'm even thinking from the perspective of having logged the footage. Like, you probably had multiple cameras all rolling at the same time, right? And you would at least be able to match footage if you wanted to, right? Like, I would assume you would at least be able to say these are all the shots of the crowd that went with this B.B. King performance or whatever.
It's hard to tell how many cameras they had. There's only like one shot I think I saw a camera in, you know, another camera.
Maybe you're right. I mean, and the guy did make it sound like it was kind of a
lower budget.
Yeah, I don't know. He didn't like flat out say it was a shoestring budget or anything, but
yeah. So the next big performance actually is the one you were thinking of, the Fifth Dimension performance. So there's a little bit in there, and I think he shows up again at another point, but like around the time they were introducing John Lindsay, I think you get a brief glimpse of jazz flautist Herbie Mann doing his thing, and he shows up
Chain
again later.
Playing Chain of Fools.
Mm-hmm. Jazz flute, not really my thing, but I respect it.
Good.
That's okay. Also kind of how I feel about the Fifth Dimension. Not really my thing, but I respect
sweet.
Them.
They're very sweet in this.
And it made me just like even happier when they're talking about like the whole process of them going to see Hair and everything. And then the cut to like, I don't know if it's the Billboard chart or whatever, because they were talking about like, oh, we heard Age of Aquarius and we were like, oh, we have to record that. We got to make that a record. Then the cut to the chart, and they're like, one of them is just very casually like, that was the biggest record in America that year. It's just like, these people seem really nice. I'm really glad they had a number one hit.
I am 90% sure I have only ever heard their version of Age of Aquarius and never the actual musical version.
Yeah, I didn't realize the song was actually that big. But like, this movie does a good job of giving most of the acts that they spotlight a little story to go along with them, you know.
And like context for like what it means to them to be part of this.
And especially here, because they're talking to some of the band members who are still alive here. But there's this whole thing about how like some people called them, how did they put it? Like, some people called them the black band with the white sound.
Yes.
And how much that bothered them, and that they really wanted to like show up here and give it their all and be like, hey, like we matter, like we are legit.
We were constantly being attacked because we weren't quote unquote black enough. Sometimes we were called the black group with the white sound. We didn't like that. We happened to be artists who are black, and our voices sound the way they sound. And how do you color? That used to be one of our questions. How do you color a sound? That was one of the reasons why performing in Harlem was so important to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because we wanted our people to know what we were about.
Mm-hmm.
And we were hoping that they would receive us.
And I think that's an understandable thing to bristle against, because it's basically trying to take their identity from them because they do a kind of music that isn't popular with their culture.
Yeah, I really liked this part.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was just a really sweet back and forth with the new interviews. And,
yeah,
and some fun stories, like you said, Brad. It's fun to hear the them banter back and forth, like the story of the wallet.
Yeah, the lost wallet and everything.
Yeah.
And the bit with like the one audience member who has the biggest crush on Marilyn McCoo, the lady from the band that is in the interviews and stuff, like him just being like, I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to leave her, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
So from there, we start to move more a little bit into some of the gospel stuff. The first one up is the Edwin Hawkins Singers. Absolutely not an artist I knew anything about prior to this. Again, I am not a gospel expert by any stretch, but from what I understand, one of the first real crossover gospel groups and acts of this time.
And from the Bay Area, which blew my mind.
Vallejo, I think.
Right. Like, I just generally assume any and every major gospel act is out of the South.
Yeah.
So, like, that was really crazy to me to see. Like, I just randomly read last night Nina Simone is from not super far from where I grew up.
Yep, North Carolina.
Oh, no kidding, yeah?
Yeah.
She's got, I don't know if you guys, I mean, we'll get to her later.
Yeah.
Really interesting person.
Oh, yeah. In both good and bad ways. Like, yeah, she had a hell of a life.
Yes.
But so, you know, a big feature of this documentary is really trying to emphasize the fact that both gospel itself was becoming somewhat mainstream, at least in terms of, like, you know, selling records and becoming popular, but it was also influencing everything else going on at this time. You know, gospel certainly is where rock and roll kind of, you know, got its germinating notes from. You know, it's a lot of things. The black gospel movement and tradition infects so much of what music in the following decades have. It's hugely important. But it's just interesting to see it on a mainstream stage like this, sandwiched between stuff like Stevie Wonder and all these like Motown acts and stuff. And everybody responding to it like it absolutely 100% belongs there.
Right. And still, yeah. And it's like, I mean, I'm certainly no gospel expert, but in its somewhat unaltered form, I guess I would say, you know?
Yeah.
Like they're still doing gospel. It's not like they have decided to transition into pop or something, because like it's only another 10-12 years after this before like Whitney Houston, for example, came out of gospel singing.
Yep.
And then went 1 bajillion % pop, you know, as soon as she broke big, you know. So like the pipeline to just much more mainstream stuff was already kind of forming, but these acts are just straight up doing it, you know.
I mean, it has been a long-standing tradition in this country for black artists to find their voice, both literally and figuratively, within the church, you know, and they talk about it here, that like a lot of that gospel stuff is such a release for both the people on the stage and the people in the audience. Like they talk about, you know, being taken by the Holy Spirit, but in some cases that is literally just a cathartic, you know, expulsion of all the emotions and feelings that they have living in this country at this time. And they repeatedly go back to it. They show people just going through these moments where it feels like they are just hammering on the guitar or just belting into the mic, like just expelling something from themselves that they have to get out there.
I forget who says it. It might be Al Sharpton, or it says something like, we didn't have therapists.
Yeah. Didn't know anything about therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. This is what we had.
Yeah.
Gospel was more than religious. Gospel was the therapy for the stress and pressure of being black in America. We didn't go to a psychiatrist. We didn't go lay on a couch. We didn't know anything about therapists. We knew Mahalia Jackson.
The next one after that is, I believe, the Staple Singers, who are definitely a crossover act. I mean, it is a family band. There's a lot of family bands around this time, and a number of these artists are, you know, brothers and sisters, and in this case, a father and three daughters, who are performing together. And, you know, the other thing besides gospel that is a huge influence on a lot of these artists is the blues. I mean, B.B. King is also here. And they talk about how Pops was not necessarily, like, you know, a church musician or anything like that. He was just a guy who knew how to play some blues guitar and how to perform music. And they just put this family band together and it turned into something.
In 1969, we were singing gospel, but we would be invited to folk festivals, jazz festivals, blues. I told Pops, I said, Daddy, why are these people inviting us to blues festivals? But we don't sing no blues. He said, maybe. Listen to our music. You will hear every kind of music in our songs.
Oh, we are dying forever. Just see how me. Just see how me. Just see how me. Just see how me.
In fact, it was years before my sisters and I knew Pops was playing the blues on his guitar while we were singing gospel. He said, Daddy, you're playing the blues. He said, that's the way I learned.
I think one of the great, I guess I would just say, like, one of my favorite small details is they do manage to get Mavis Staples to come in and talk a little bit. They don't put her on camera, but she does come in and narrate some stuff and talk about the event and, you know, what ends up happening with her and Mahalia Jackson. You know, like, it's nice to have that firsthand account of what was happening there.
Yeah, and they get some good interview footage of Pop Staples in here talking about buying his first guitar and how he made $3 a week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
working
that whole thing is amazing.
Working on a cotton farm.
First guitar, I paid $5 for it.
$5.
Picking cotton, climbing.
And how much did you make about a day?
I made $3 a week.
$3 a week?
50 cents a day. 14 hours a day. It wasn't easy. It was tough.
And then, yes, the next, I think the Mahalia Jackson performance is not too long after this. And man, you know, you hear people talk about her in this documentary, like she is just a straight up god of this kind of music and a truly revered figure. And the performance she gives is immediately illustrative of why that is, because even in her slightly diminished state where she's not feeling great, you know, she is having health problems at this time. When she gets on that microphone, fuck, man, she just kills. I don't know, man. It's just, it's one of those performances that, like, the whole time, even again, as someone who is not a big gospel listener, like, I felt like a certain electricity kind of going through my body as I was listening to her. Now, after this, after that, just again, that incredible Mahalia Jackson performance, we move back into a little bit more of the pop realm. And the next one up is David Ruffin, formerly of The Temptations. A beanpole of a man.
Yeah. Lanky.
But very charismatic on stage. And
I don't think I'd ever seen him full body.
Yeah.
I didn't know him by name either. Like, I obviously know the Temptations, but I didn't know their individual names. So I couldn't have told you he was of that group.
He was the main singer Temptations. He was like the lead vocalist and also apparently the one that had the biggest ego and had basically led to the Temptations more or less splitting up or splitting into different factions.
Yeah. And also, like, it kind of calling back to the thing I mentioned later on where Chris Rock shows up and, like, he's not, you know, he's like casting intentional shade exactly, but he was talking about, like, are you just going to sing your 60s hits forever like the Temptations? And, like, sure enough, here is the lead guy from the Temptations singing one of their hits from earlier in the decade.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's not that I don't think people in that audience want to hear My Girl. I'm sure they do.
You and you would say, what pretty new girl can make a
I don't know. Like, I don't know the full history there, but my understanding was that, like, his career kind of went sideways not long after he broke from the Temptations.
Yeah, I mean, that's, like, that's kind of the history of, like, musical trends, especially cultural trends to a broader extent, but, like, music in particular, like, some people adapt and some people get left behind, right? And,
yeah.
Like, we're really going to see that when we talk about the Sly Stone stuff in a few minutes and mm-hmm. what some of the audience members say about that, you know, that, like, things were very much on the cusp of change here. And some people took off their suit and tie and others kept it on.
I'll add too. I didn't know this either. It was when I looked up Ruffin. I think he also died fairly young.
Yeah. Okay. And he died at 50 of a drug overdose.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's like a lot of tragedy in this,
yeah.
These artists as well for various reasons. So like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. Ruffin had an ego. It ran afoul of the other people in the Temptations. At one point, I think he wanted to rename the group David Ruffin and the Temptations, and that really pissed everyone off. And then, yeah, he fell into drug use not too long after this. That said, good performance of My Girl, a song I don't really like that much. I like other Temptation songs better, but, you know, it is a classic for a reason. And then we are on to Gladys Knight and the Pips. Shout out to Gladys Knight, still looking great.
Shout out to Gladys Knight. Also, shout out to the Pips.
Yeah.
Fucking moving and working.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like I said, these are the guys you can see sweating through the suit jacket.
Yeah.
It's so, and we'll talk about this when we get to Sly Stone as well, but like one of the things they use to frame Sly and the Family Stone is that they are extremely not a band that is done up the same. You know, like they don't all wear the same outfits. That was very much the style, as they say specifically, of like, you know, of black vocal groups to kind of, you know, have tandem fashion, tandem sort of dance moves and all that kind of stuff. And Gladys Knight and the Pips, even though it, you know, that group kind of grew a little bit beyond just sort of like the vocal group stuff that they're doing here, they are very much of that type at this time, you know, yeah. Like it is still that flavor of performance.
I don't know if they specifically came out of the Motown machine, but that was like
they
very
did.
Much. Right. And they even touch on it in here, you know, like they name drop Berry Gordy a little bit here. Like mm-hmm. that was very much like a boot camp, right?
Yeah.
Or like churning out artists, you know, it's like, hey, you're going to practice this choreography 12 hours a day because you are going to be perfect because we are manufacturing a product here for mass consumption and nothing is going to get in the way of the assembly line continuing to roll.
Yeah. So Gladys Knight and the Pips in particular, I think, had problems with Motown because they kind of got shunted to the secondary label at Motown. And they thought they were getting all the leftover songs. Because at the time, songwriters were writing songs for Motown. They were not writing songs for individual artists, usually. Sometimes I think they were, but like it was usually only for the biggest artists. And generally speaking, what they were doing was writing songs, putting them into the pool, and then Motown was deciding who recorded what when. And so they felt like they were not getting the material that some of the other bigger acts on Motown were getting. And it sounds like they had a lot of static with Motown over the years, though they did also have some hits with Motown eventually. It just took a while. After Gladys Knight, here we are, Sly and the Family Stone. Kind of one of, I would say, of the bands or an artist on here, I would say one of the three most like marquee and like head top line acts in terms of like what I wanted to see here.
Yeah. And this, this feels like the kind of the centerpiece of the movie to an extent to me, because it's about the midway point of the movie. And it's also everything before this has been like BB King, gospel acts, Motown, like a little bit more of the previous era,
the classics. Yeah.
And like this very much is signaling like, okay, here's some new shit coming in.
It is some new shit.
And this is where the dude, I love this guy. I love this gentleman who was just an audience member that they talked to in this, who's like kind of soft spoken. And they've like during the Temptations part, he's like, oh, me and my friends, we were suit and tie guys. You know, we were so yeah. excited for David Ruffin. And then he was like, you know, we were suit and tie guys. Then Sly Stone came out. Then we were no longer suit and tie guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's like two things they say, you know, it's like, when Sly is about to come to the stage, you don't actually know if Sly is about to come to the stage. And two, this band is more like a bunch of people waiting for a bus than it is the sort of like, you know, carefully coiffed and manufactured look that a lot of these other artists have.
I love Sly and the Family Stone. I think pound for pound for the years they were active.
Yeah.
Just
incredible.
hit machines, like unbelievable. It's like, I think it's not even like 10 years of actual being out there. But man, that thing just falls apart. Not in the movie.
No.
But,
because this is right before it starts to fall apart for Sly and the Family Stone. But I will say here, Sly Stone at this point, you know, he has been in this band for a little bit. He started out as a radio DJ in the Bay Area, put this band together out of a mixture of family members and various cohorts. One thing they do mention here, and this is actually notable, is that he has women musicians in the band that aren't just vocalists.
Cynthia.
Yeah, Cynthia.
On the trumpet.
Yeah. And, like, that is actually kind of novel for this time, the idea of letting women be performers in the band but not having to put them front and center as vocalists, necessarily.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also appreciated, I mean, of course I did, but I liked the line from, there's a musician and writer they talk to, I forget his name, repeatedly in this, who mentions that Sly Stone was a conservatory student and multi-instrumentalist.
Yep.
Which the writer describes as he's like kind of a proto prince or whatever, but like I do enjoy that idea of him as like a highly multi-talented, slightly eccentric guy, you know.
Clear, he did not play the electric organ until he started this band. He was a guitarist. And so the reason he switched over was because his brother was playing guitar in the band. And he's like, we don't need to both play guitar. So he literally says, like, I'm just going to learn organ. And he did.
Yeah. It's really an amazing collaboration. I, the vibes also of the band are
yes.
Are
great. This is the first time I saw this on an airplane. This was definitely my favorite performance.
Yeah.
Or like the one that really stuck with me.
It's this, and it's probably Nina Simone for me. Those are the ones that really just like stuck out the most. But so I will just note that if you read the timeline of the Sly and Family Stone decline, it literally is months after this performance because they moved to L.A. not too long after this, and that's when they start getting into hard drugs.
Is that when like the cascade of drummers, the original drummer leaves and then they just like swap them all out?
He's around for a bit, I think. I don't know if he was into the hard drugs as much as maybe some of the other band members were, but he was there for a little while. But literally what they say is like fall of 1969 is when drug use begins.
Mm.
And they were apparently doing a lot of cocaine and a lot of PCP. So
yikes,
that'll do it. Listen, Sly Stone, still alive.
Still alive. I don't know.
At what cost?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
But
it's again, there's that documentary about Sly. I forget exactly what it's called, but it's something like The Burden of like Black Genius or something.
Yeah, that's the Questlove one.
Which I've wanted to watch and check out, but I don't know. Like, I really like Sly and the Family Stone. I'm afraid it just might be too depressing. Like, But
it will be. I'm telling you right now, it will be.
Yeah. Like, there's just so much potential there. Like, everybody's so talented.
Yeah. Now, this is the section where they start getting in a little bit more of, like, the, you know, adjacent cultural aspects of the show. You know, they bring in Mongo Santa Maria. They start talking about, you know, the way that African fashion was starting to take hold this time.
When we got into the late 60s, there was a new movement, Afrocentric.
It's a revolution, style revolution. Cultural revolution. We found that the African styles just
suit us
better.
I can remember dashikis. Everybody had a dashiki. I think I had a dashiki.
Now, the dashiki is an adaptation of an African piece. What we mean when we say dashiki is freedom. So it's a freedom suit. I can move in any direction. I never am attacked.
They also start talking a little bit about, you know, the Latin American influence here. You get a performance here by Ray Barretto. You also get a Lin-Manuel Miranda jump scare for a brief period here.
Yes.
He just kind of wanders in.
What year did this come out? I mean, this is probably still like peak Lin-Manuel Miranda being everywhere. Right?
I think it was 2021.
All
right. Like, I don't want to be super mean, but like, I assume that's Lin-Manuel Miranda's dad.
And his dad is a musician as well.
His dad looks like it looks like they are doing a shot where it's both played by Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah,
sure.
They look and act so much alike that it looks like one of those, like, there's a piece of glass between them or something, and he's just talking to himself.
I mean, they have basically the same haircut. It's just that one is gray and one is dark-haired and the same goatee. So yeah. I can see how you would
and
make that connection. Yeah. I mean, it is his dad.
Yeah. I mean, they both seem very pleasant, but like,
yeah.
it just made me laugh. Like, the family resemblance is strong.
Yeah. But I think these performances are good and interesting, and also I think it's important that they note that, like, you know, there is a multicultural aspect to this.
I mean, there's Harlem and there's East Harlem.
Yeah, and all those people are here for this show because it is actually representing a pretty wide swath of different cultures and music styles here.
Yeah, I don't know if you mentioned you gotta give it up for the Sheila E. appearance as well.
Yes, a very brief one. All too brief. I'm always happy to see her.
Oh, is that when she talks about, like, using your wrist versus
playing with your wrists and not your hands? Yeah. There was a good bit in here. I can't find it. I think it's around this point when they're talking about changes in fashion, or it might be later. There's a writer that I wish I had her name in front of me. It is, okay, Charlene Hunter was her name at the time. I'm not sure what her married name is. I don't have the subtitle in front of me, but she was talking about the effort to reclaim the word black because been very much a pejorative term across the culture previously, to the point that she went out of her way to use the word black in her stories.
Yeah.
And the white editors were changing it back to Negro, and she had to, like, fight.
In 1969, I was working at the New York Times, and I spent a lot of time in Harlem. And for the first time, I wrote black instead of Negro in a story, because I listened to the community. I listened to the people who were calling for the change. But some white editor changed my wording from black back to Negro. I was so upset. I dictated an 11-page memo calling for the change. And the editor, Abe Rosenthal, said, fine, that's what we're going to do. From that point on at the New York Times, people of color, this color, were referred to as black.
I mean, that's, you know, that's one of the utilities of a film like this is that it's, like I said, it has a great power to educate on things that people like us were not familiar with before.
Yeah. Like, I think all of us were probably at the very least familiar with a lot of the broad strokes of the civil rights movement that are touched on here, but there are some real hyper specifics in here that you wouldn't know if you weren't part of that culture or you hadn't done the research. And in this case, this was eye opening in a lot of ways.
We're older.
Yeah.
But this is only like 10 years before I was born. You know, this isn't ancient history. This is stuff that the reverberations probably were felt in our lifetimes. Not just echoes of it, right? Like, people who attended or heard of it were probably in our orbits.
Yeah, because I was born in 1981. This happened in 1969. I'm trying to track the distance between, I mean, 12 years ago from this day that when we were recording this.
Yeah, I mean, like, Obama was just into his second term 12 years ago.
So, like, think about the amount of time that passed between, you know, when we were born and all the shit that's happened since then just the amount of time that this actual movement took place.
Yeah.
We're up now to one of my favorite little personal bits, specifically the Abby Lincoln, Max Roach performance, because I love Max Roach. Look, I'm not going to stand here and pretend I'm aware of and well-versed in all the many, many, many jazz recordings he has been a part of. But I know Max Roach well because I am myself a drummer. And if you've ever taken drum lessons in your life and you want to study jazz at any point in your life, Max Roach is one of those names that definitely comes up. And he is, I think, one of the all-time greats of jazz drumming. And in this case, you know, he's here with his then wife, Abby Lincoln, and they are given a real, like, just, I don't know how to describe this other than to say, it's just a real humdinger of a performance.
I'm not actually too familiar with Max Roach outside of his work with, like, I think it was Duke Ellington and maybe Charles Mingus. I think they have, like, a very famous album. So I don't know. I actually don't know a lot of Max Roach's stuff.
So, I mean, he has recorded with everyone from Dizzy Gillespie to Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, like you said, Duke Ellington, Thelonious Monk, like Mingus, as you said, Sonny Rollins. Like, he was an in-demand jazz drummer, especially at the height of kind of, you know, the swing and jazz era. At this time, obviously, jazz is different and it is maybe not as much at the forefront, but, you know, a lot of those jazz infused artists are becoming big at this time. And it's just interesting to see him out here, you know, with his wife, you know, just kind of doing this performance. Like, I don't think of Max Roach necessarily as like front and center in a group usually, but it's fucking cool to see him here doing this for an audience that is just eating it up.
Yeah.
And then we come to Nina Simone. Nina Simone, as we alluded to, has one of the wildest lives, I feel like, of any modern American singer. Has lived a lot of different places for a lot of different reasons, but at this time is still in the United States and is still performing regularly. And how do I describe this? If there is anyone on this earth whose voice just straight up melts me every fucking time, no matter what the song is or what the performance is, Nina Simone might be that artist.
She just
has this power, man.
It's funny you say that because I really like Nina Simone's voice too. My wife is not as big a fan, like as far as jazz singers go, but I really like it too. I'm a fan of it. I find it very powerful. Like it's
very powerful, but it's also just something about the way she delivers her singing just destroys me every time, in like the best way. Like I really, it's music I go back to time and time again. Now, look, I'm not going to stand here and say I was a lifelong Nina Simone fan. My introduction to her was literally the part that uses Sinner Man from the movie The Thomas Crown Affair. Okay. So, like, that was my introduction. But after that, loving that song, I started digging into her stuff when I was, like, I don't know, like 18, 19. And as jazz singers go, I don't have many favorites. I do not love a lot of that music, but I love her.
Also, she's, again... The biography is, I think she also, didn't she have late diagnosis of mental illness as well?
Or bipolar disorder.
Bipolar,
yes.
Yeah.
So she was going through some of that stuff, you know, throughout the 70s and the 80s. She had a very tumultuous time. Her daughter said that at times she became very, you know, at times abusive because of the bipolar disorder. You know, she did not have a giant music career later in her life. She was just kind of performing here and there. But here, it feels like she is, if as much as Sly and the Family Stone is really the centerpiece of a lot of this musical stuff, I feel like she is the emphatic punctuation mark on what the music of this thing is. Because they give her multiple songs in the movie. And also, one of those performances is her really just giving a call to action to the audience as she is reading this poem and just sort of like, telling this audience, like, what will you do? What will you stand up for? Are you willing to fight? Are you willing to kill? Like, it is the most militant sounding thing that comes from anyone on this stage.
Are you ready? Are you ready to change into a groovy black person? Are you really ready to change yourself? Turn yourself inside out, through and through, and make yourself a through and through and through and through.
Oh yeah, that's the Fox News clip they're playing over and over again.
I couldn't help noting there are quite a few NYPD officers lining the stage while she's giving that poem performance, if you notice.
Yes, they are definitely looking a little fidgety and uncomfortable while this is going on, though no one does anything. Like the audience is just rapt with attention. This isn't a spark off to some sort of riot or tragic event. It's just people hanging on her every word.
Yeah, it's a powerful section.
To me, I feel like a lot of people will watch that part, and it's the sort of thing that definitely makes, you know, the people who are of the like more nonviolent side of things uncomfortable. You know, when a woman on stage says something like, "Are you willing to kill?" You know, like that's a harsh thing to come out of a musician at a festival stage. But at the same time, that's what was going on. Like, this was a life or death struggle for a lot of people. And I think sometimes that gets lost in some of the historical whitewashing of what this era was. Like, we talk about segregation and how that was a thing we overcame. We talk about racism as if that was a thing we overcame. Clearly, we did not. And so, at the time, people were getting killed. And I understand where that militancy and that intensity comes from.
Yeah, and I'll just add, just as a reminder, back what you said before, where you're getting all sides of these of this leadership for this movement being killed, right?
Yeah, it doesn't matter what your approach is. If you are a person who is, you know, at the forefront of trying to push civil rights, there is a chance someone will assassinate you.
Yeah.
There's a, again, from a documentary making perspective, there's another story kind of intercut with this big extended Nina Simone performance at the end.
Yes.
Which is that it's that writer, that reporter that I mentioned earlier, Charlaine Hunter, mm-hmm. who they've been talking to in on present day as a talking head, you know, as a, like, here's one of the cultural experts we brought in. Like, I thought this was a really effective way for Questlove to construct this movie, is that only like 10 minutes from the end of the movie do they drop the fact that she was, now I'm not on it and I can't tell you what school it was.
It was University of Georgia.
Okay. Like she drops the fact that, hey, I was one of the first two black students to be desegregated at the University of Georgia. You know, it's mm-hmm. like, oh wow, you have just been here as like a expert commentator this whole time. But like, actually you are a person yourself of great historical significance, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, they go through quite a bit of her experience as the first black female student at this previously white university. Like, I thought that was like a really like powerful story to tell right at the end.
Many white students didn't want us there.
Do you think there'd be any trouble if a Negro entered the university?
Well, I do if they were going to put her in the dormitories.
How do you yourself feel?
Well, I wouldn't myself like it.
The second or third night I was on campus, there was a riot. They put me in a dormitory on the first floor. All of the girls in my dorm were housed on the second floor, and they used to take turns beating on the floor because they knew exactly where my room was. But I had Nina Simone's albums, so while the girls were upstairs beating on the floor, trying to make me uncomfortable, I was listening to Nina Simone and just being very at peace.
And the newspaper she went on to write for was the New York Times. So
yeah,
I don't know how to express it, but like, it is a thing that should not be forgotten. Like,
yeah,
you know, that should be brought up, that these things happened, you know, it's kind
and
of,
so close, like honestly, so close to our lifetimes.
Right. Not that far away. You know, I think it's easy to just assume, you know, life began in the 2000s or something.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of real,
gnarly history
that maybe gets swept away. I think, Brad, like you said, maybe sometimes intentionally, maybe sometimes not, disappeared, right?
Yeah. And I think honestly one of the great triumphs of this documentary, as I said before, is just the way that Questlove wields the history and applies it to the various musical performances. It's very easy to imagine a version of this documentary that is very airy and very sort of lightweight and maybe touches a little bit on the history. And so I was like, oh, you know, it was a tough time for black people in America, but check out all this great music we found, you know, mm-hmm. like that version of that movie would probably be compelling enough, but I think the interweaving of that stuff and how it is wielded is really kind of the deft and expert touch here.
Yeah.
Because it does make it lends the right amount of weight to that stuff while also giving weight to the music itself.
Yeah. Like, there are so many different things touched on in this, you know, there's like the different areas of Harlem and how that stuff is laid out, like what New York politics were like at the time, race relations, like how fashion was changing, like mm-hmm. the desegregation that we just talked about. Like, we'd even talk about the Apollo 11 landing happening in the middle of this and how they integrate that into the narrative. You know, like, there's just a lot of aspects of history that are included in this in a really nice, seamless way.
I think the interview footage they get with some of the concert goers while the Apollo 11 landing is happening is really fascinating stuff, because I've certainly heard the story that, you know, black Americans were not as invested in that thing because they were just like, you're spending money on this shit and you are letting people live in poverty, you know.
Yeah, and there's a really famous poem about that.
There are 40,000, perhaps 50,000 people at Mount Morris Park in Harlem, but they are not here watching the moon landing. They are here at the Soul Festival, part of the third annual Harlem Cultural Festival. And for many of them, this is far more relevant than the mission of Apollo 11. What's your feeling now that the astronauts have landed safely on the moon?
I think it's very important, but I don't think it's any more relevant than, you know, the Harlem Cultural Festival here. I think it's equal.
What are your thoughts?
As far as science goes and everybody that's involved with the moon landing and astronauts, it's beautiful, you know. Like me, I couldn't care less.
The cash, this means more to you than that.
Yeah, much more. Cash they wasted, as far as I'm concerned, in getting to the moon could have been used to feed poor black people in Harlem and all over the place, all over this country. So, like, you know, like, never mind the moon. Let's get some of that cash in Harlem.
Yeah, there's some pretty good documentary editing of cutting the, like, it's amazing. Like, we were all coming together for this, and then coming back to the festival being like, what? Like, no, like, what are you talking about? Like, why are we spending money going to the moon?
Yeah. But that's it, right? Like, that's really the thrust of this whole thing. You know, I mean, maybe there's one thing they could have done that they didn't do, which was juxtapose a little more of this against actual Woodstock. Like, they talk about it, they mention it, but there's no, it's, you know, they don't use any footage. They don't really mention the fact that several of these artists did actually perform at Woodstock, Sly and the Family Stone, most notable among them. But, you know, all the cultural cachet, all the emphasis, all the, you know, the big moment and big moment energy is directed at Woodstock and is directed at the Apollo 11 landing, which are big momentous events in and of themselves. But you can just get the sense that everyone just feels like no one's paying attention to this except the people who live here.
Mm-hmm.
And but now we are paying attention to it, too.
Right. Yeah. Again, kind of amazing this thing laid buried for so long.
And it's just great ending it on the note of that guy who went to this concert. And as Brad, I think you mentioned before, you know, the thing he says is that, like,
you know, it's funny. You put memories away and you don't realize, sometimes you don't even know if they're real. So it's almost confirmation that what I knew is real.
Yeah, so you know you're not crazy. Like,
I'm not crazy. Thank you.
So watching you watch this is making me overwhelmed now. I thought I was the only person that...
I knew I wasn't crazy, brother. I knew I was not crazy. But now I know I'm not. And this is just confirmation. And not only that, how beautiful it was.
He had never seen footage from this thing. None of these people, for the most part, had ever seen footage from this thing anywhere. And for him seeing it again, it made him feel like his memory was real. Like, he hadn't just invented details. Like, look, we talk all the time about how our memories are extremely squishy these days, and there's lots of stuff that we can't quite get a feel for or remember, you know, because as we're getting older. But, you know, something like this, the big cultural moment that basically no one talked about for nearly 50 years, and to just have it there in, you know, live and in color for you to remember all that stuff and be like, no, that really happened. Yes, I remember seeing that. Yes. That's powerful.
Yeah, it really is.
It's a good one.
No one's going to do that for the first Warped Tour that I went to.
No, are you sure? You're not going to find the tapes?
I don't think so.
Well, I think part of that probably, and even Woodstock to some extent, is the reproduce it until it's dead in the ground, right? Like,
yes.
Continue to monetize, like, until it's gone. And maybe some of the magic of this was that it was one-off, for better or worse, and lives as this really unique experience that was never recreated again. Didn't have a chance to be inshittified.
Yeah, I mean, especially like contrast with Woodstock 94 and 99 and the complete shit show that those were, yep. That like those had a chance to come along and kind of tarnish the Woodstock name.
Right. Yeah, you kind of have this thing, which in its presentation in the documentary just comes off as very pure and kind of wholesome in this cultural moment. The most appropriate thing, right? The like,
yeah.
And it, recreating that later on, maybe if we were very familiar with this as a brand, I don't think it would have the same impact.
Yeah, it's worth noting there were previous Harlem cultural festivals to this one. They were not anywhere near at the scale of this one. They had talked about doing it as early as 1964. There was a first one in 1967. But that barely, as far as I can tell, there were not really a lot of like headlining acts for that thing. And it was mostly an excuse to get people out into the city. Like, they were doing things like boxing demonstrations. There was a go-kart Grand Prix. Like, it seems like more of like a carnival than like a straight up festival. And then they did another one in 1968 that did have a couple of these artists, like Mahalia Jackson performed at that one too. And like Tito Puente and like Count Basie played at that, but it was nowhere near as big and expansive as this one was. And as far as I can tell, they didn't do another one like this after the fact.
Do you know why?
I don't know, honestly. Like, there isn't much I can find other than maybe just, you know, the political wind shifted and they just decided not to do it.
Yeah, like Woodstock, it wasn't like a 1970 Woodstock, right? Like,
no, they never did Woodstock again until the 90s, as we all know.
I think when I was looking this up, there was some anniversary that they did another...
yeah, it was like a 50 years after the fact, okay. I think. Yeah, in 2019.
I think the documentary paints a very... like, if this thing in its original form was this momentous and special, this documentary seems to capture and portray that. Like, you know, I can only go by what's presented in the documentary. It does a very good job of presenting just how meaningful and special this thing was at the time.
Yeah. I think the true mark of a great concert doc is how badly do I wish I was in that audience. And I would say I'm hitting the red on the dial as far as my desire and wish to have been there and seen this happen.
Yeah. Especially if you're just walking by.
Yeah.
Right. And you're just like,
I mean, there's no walking by. You were going to have to slide in between some people to get in there once that,
but
thing
I'm sure you
off,
heard
but...
that music from more than a few blocks away.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it's all the context that's given to it. Cause like, that's the best thing that a documentary can do for me, is to have me walk away from it feeling like I've gained like greater cultural knowledge and understanding generally. And like, I feel like I learned a lot about that period of time in that specific part of the country, in that culture, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like
this very specific slice of America. I learned a lot.
Yeah. Same. And I will say, you know, just as someone who has seen a lot of concert docs and just straight up concert films, this is probably one of the best ones I've ever seen.
Mm.
Like, just in terms of pure construction, the value of the material that it has and how it chooses to handle it. Like, it doesn't feel like this is Questlove's first movie. Like, it is exceedingly well directed, and that even doesn't account for just how good the footage that they just happened upon happens to be.
Yeah. Again, shout out to the audio recording on it.
Yeah. There is an official soundtrack album out there. It is mostly the songs you hear in the movie, from what I recall. So, you know, there aren't like a lot of like B-sides or anything. Weirdly enough, this movie only came out on DVD.
Huh.
Not even Blu-ray.
Interesting. And it was.
I don't know if that was part of some sort of like streaming deal they had where they couldn't do like a high def release or something.
Yeah.
But it's weird. I'm not really sure why that is.
Because it's up for streaming in 4K, right?
Yeah. And they've clearly upscaled some of that footage, obviously.
Yeah,
but it still looks pretty good. Well, nonetheless, that is Summer of Soul. Great fucking movie. Vinny.
Yeah.
Where's it going on your list?
Oh, man. Getting into it with these docs. They're tough to place. They're tough to place because they're, you know, educational and entertaining. I have it at number 14 on my list. And that is
fantastic.
That is very, it is beating Demolition Man and Red October, which is pretty high praise for my list. Couldn't outdo Porco Rosso though. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know Questlove personally. Yeah. I feel like he'd be okay.
He'd
with
respect
that.
It. I think.
Yeah.
I think he'd respect it. Yes. There's it's getting pretty tough at the top there. You're going to have to really work your way into take out old Porco Rosso, okay?
Yeah.
I really like that one.
I haven't quite decided where it's going to go on my list yet because I haven't announced my list yet.
Mm.
So at the end of this month, I'm going to announce my own ordered list. I was wondering if I was going to wait until we got to 100 movies or something, but with Star Trek Summer looming, I feel like the time is nigh. And so when we are done with this month, the last episode of May, I will announce what my ordered list is. And just like yours, it's going to be perfect.
That's right. That's right. Two perfect lists.
Yeah.
Some people said it couldn't happen, but
yeah,
it's amazing.
We'll find our way. Brad, you are under no pressure to do this yourself. I am not going to pressure you into doing it.
I don't know if I could, because when I look at that list, like some of the first things we watched, I have a hard time remembering.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to go watch Michael Clayton again at this point.
Have to.
I mean, you know what I mean. Like, it's just,
yeah. Oh yeah.
It's a lot to remember there.
Even on my list, if I were to make it today with everything, it would probably be 50% different.
Yeah. And mine might shift around over time as well. We'll find out. But that list will come at the end of the month. We're not there yet. Brad, thank you for bringing this one to our attention. Mm-hmm. This movie's fantastic.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Next week's movie, also a music documentary of a very different stripe. Maybe culturally significant in its own way, but in an extremely different way. This is Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, the documentary that details the period when Metallica was trying to make Saint Anger, and against all odds, against all reason, against all good taste, did. I don't think that's a spoiler. That album came out in 2003. Everyone knows. So they finished the album. But what happened over the course of making that movie is really something.
I know one thing about this album, and I will save it for the next time we get into it. I don't know. Is that one thing, Alex? You know what it is because I've talked to you about it. Is that mentioned in the documentary at all?
It's been long enough since I've seen it that I don't remember if they ever actually address that aspect of the album.
Okay.
A lot of it is really just about the interpersonal drama and the egotistical backbiting that goes on in what was at the time probably the biggest mainstream rock band of the era.
Okay. Okay. So I will save it for next time. The one thing that as someone who did not know this album but knew of this album.
Now, Brad, we mentioned this, I think, last time when we were talking about some of the stuff. Not only have you not heard Saint Anger, you've never heard a Metallica album after the Black Album, have you?
No, like I don't remember how much of this I said on the podcast, but Metallica was like very close to my favorite band when I was like 13, 14. Never listened to a thing after the Black Album.
Now, is that because you hated the Black Album and thought they sold out, or just because you just weren't interested?
No, the Black Album was the first thing I heard, and then like Enter Sandman on MTV was the gateway, and then I went back and got all the other albums prior to that. Like, Injustice for All might be my favorite, I'm not sure.
It's between that and Master Puppets for me.
Yeah, like, those are probably the two at this point, but...
But I also love the Black Album. I think the Black Album is great.
Yes, yes, it's you know, for all the shit it took from Metallica fans at the time, it's legitimately great, but... I just got into other music after that, and from all accounts, sounds like I punched out at the right time on that.
I was going to say, maybe Metallica kind of did, too.
Yeah.
Yep. All I've ever heard about this movie is, like, basically people talking about it in the sense of, like, I can't believe they were willing to put that on film.
I mean, there's a couple points in the movie where it seems like they are unable to believe they are putting this on film.
Like, kind of like, I can't believe somebody would allow this kind of behavior to be shown in public or something.
Yeah, for a band that like is very much about its image and sort of projecting a particular aura, it really punctures that in a pretty significant way.
Yeah, I'm pretty curious to see it.
It's a great movie. It's, you know, look, as much as this movie was like, you know, pregnant with meaning and cultural, like, you know, importance and things like that, this is a bunch of rich guys bitching at each other for roughly 2 hours, but I do think there is something valuable in watching kind of the unmaking of an image of a band that big and that heavy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And also, I feel like as much as maybe we're not the editorial voice to go really critically appraise Summer of Soul, we are absolutely the voice for early Metallica, the three white guys to talk about early Metallica. I feel like that is our middle school, high school band that 100%. Everyone was touched by. When they show stuff from the 90s and late 80s of people wearing Metallica shirts, that's probably us.
There's at least one Metallica shirt still in my parents' basement.
Who among us does not have a Metallica drawn on a marble notebook somewhere? Yep.
Found some of those too.
Right.
I regret to inform you, Brad, you could probably sell that t-shirt for like $300.
Oh, probably. Yeah. I was not brave enough to get the metal up your ass shirt.
I think you made the right choice.
They sold Metallica tickets at my high school. That is that's to go to the concert. That's
right when the Black Album broke big. They're a Bay Area band. They played in my hometown.
Man.
Like the last show they did at the Phoenix Theater in Petaluma was just a couple of years before I started hanging out there regularly, and I was living there, but I just narrowly missed it.
Wait, isn't that like a pretty small theater?
It's like a 1,000-person theater, 900 to 1,000.
They played a theater on the Black Album tour?
This is before the Black Album fully went crazy. This was when Enter Sandman was like just starting to get big radio play.
I see.
If I remember correctly.
Okay. Because by the time I wanted to go to the Metallica, maybe we're just burning material for next week. I wanted to go to the Metallica Guns N' Roses tour so fucking bad.
Oh wow.
As a like 12-year-old, 13-year-old, did not make it happen.
Well, we'll talk about those, you know, those could have been, should have been concerts and a whole lot of other things related to Metallica when we get to next week's movie. Some Kind of Monster. It's up next. I think it's great. I'm curious to see how you guys respond to it. But that is our film for next week. And that is going to put a wrap on this week's show. As always, thank you, Brad. Thank you, Vinny.
Thank you.
Thank you to everyone who's been listening and watching along at home with us. We will see you next time. Brought to you by Maxwell House.